Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. My name is Bob, and reading today from the Scarlet Threads, we begin now the final part of the historical section of Scarlet Threads, Part 5. It's called The Great Transformation. We're going to be covering the years from 1948 until somewhat to the present time, more like the 1990s, but roughly the present time. Let's go to section 49 in the book. It's called The Birth of Israel. Now, some Christians would say that one of the most exciting events in all modern history is the episode involving God's promises to the nation Israel. In 1948, the Gentile domination of the Promised Land began its end as Israel raised the Star of David over the land that shall one day see the seed of David enthroned. None of this is attributable to the Vatican. Theodor Herzl, the father of the modern Zionist movement in the late 19th century, was granted a 30-minute interview with the reigning Pope, asking him for both money and spiritual support. He's flatly turned down for both. To the Roman way of thinking, Jewish occupation of Jewish territory, that's anathema. You'll remember the Crusades, the attempt of Rome to free the Holy Land, not for its original residents, but for itself. You'll recall also that here, God intervened and simply said to Rome, "No, this is mine." The land was to be preserved for that special moment when God would call to Israelis all over the world to people their ancient possession. The Romanists see only the political ramifications of all of this and begin to hurt the Muslims, who already control all the Middle East. Of course, Rome is in pain for its own unmet needs too, and thus the Vatican uses diplomatic pressure in the late 40s to turn the UN Assembly against Zionism, in favor of internationalizing Jerusalem. Further, it works closely with Muslims to meet their ends. It's not until January of 1994 that Israel and the Vatican form ties. Well, anti-Semitic is one thing. Anti-Israel, it's the same thing, magnified. Only recently has the Vatican finally corrected, at least outwardly, hundreds of years of abuse to the Jew. We'll talk about it in a little while, this great transformation. It's coming. But first, let's talk about Protestantino. Anti-Jew, anti-Protestant threads run side by side, of course. In 1949, Vittorio Genovese of Pompeii, Italy, publishes Protestanti No, a document which plays the anti-Protestant blues eloquently. I bring it in as an additional evidence of 20th century Romanism's connection with 16th century Romanism, just in case you have any doubt about the connection. Genovese, approved by Rome, says that Protestants are disgraceful apostates of the sanctuary, in whom there is not a shadow of good faith. The heads of Protestantism were true and real criminals worthy of jail. Their principles are immoral and bring about anarchy. Spoken not too very long ago, is Babylon going to change? It's getting uncomfortably close to the present. Now, I've got to stop here because I just said Babylon. You may have just joined us for the first time wondering what in the world Babylon has to do with what I'm talking about. Well, I have traced historically the Babylon of the Bible, the mysteries of old Babylon, Babylonia, passed on to Assyria, then back to Babylonia, then to Medo-Persia, then to Greece, then to pagan Rome, and then to papal Rome. I understand that the Roman Catholic system has much that is true in it, but I understand that it has much that is false also. and God's people must come out of it. It is, I believe, the Babylon, the same Babylon that was in view back in the days of Genesis. It hasn't changed. Its head is Satan, and Satan wants world control and will use Babylon to try to get it. Well, let's watch carefully now, lest we miss whatever it is that has so radically silenced a people known for their eloquence, and some would add their verbosity, and that is the Protestant preachers. The most outspoken of them all is the one we today call Dr. William Franklin Graham. Just Billy in those days. Billy is quoted as saying that the three gravest menaces faced by Orthodox Christianity are communism, Roman Catholicism, and Mohammedanism, Islam. That was 1948. Billy Graham, champion of truth, carrier on of the line that starts with Christ, is passed on to his apostles, and then the smaller and smaller groups of believers to the Middle Ages, the Reformers, the Wesleys, Ironside, Hiley, Hyslop, and many others. But change is in the wind. We'll talk about another Billy Graham a little later. Well, it's now the Holy Year, 1950. Pope Pius is on the throne. We're going to talk about pomp and circumstance here, Roman style. Yes, Pope Pius is taking the worship of all his subjects. You can call it what you want. I'll say it's worship. Paul Blanchard, who writes about all this, says that every major celebration was systematically organized to demonstrate the homage of Catholics to Pius XII. His very and every appearance in a gorgeous processional was the signal for wild cheers of adulation. Thousands of pilgrims knelt in reverence before his bejeweled figure. He was born into the middle of every celebration, seated on his portable throne. Hyslop writes of another such Roman celebration. He says the drums were heard beating without. The guns of the soldiers rung on the stone pavement of the house of God. How unlike the suitable preparation to receive a minister of the meek and lowly Jesus. Now moving slowly up between two armed lines of soldiers, appeared a long procession of ecclesiastics, bishops, canons, cardinals, preceding the Roman pontiff, who was borne on a gilded chair, clad in vestments, resplendent as the sun. His bearers were 12 men clad in crimson, being immediately preceded by several persons carrying a cross, his mitre, his triple crown, and other insignia of his office, along on the shoulders of men, amid the gaping crowds. His head was shaded or canopied by two immense fans, made of peacock's feathers, which were borne by two attendants. And then Blanchard tells of the first saint, quote-unquote, that he saw canonized, that's officially placed on the Roman roll of sainthood. Quote, canonization is a ceremony of magnificent solemnity. The Basilica of St. Peter's has, for many centuries, been destined for solemn canonizations. It's a very ancient custom to decorate the basilica with great splendor on such occasions. Banners, candelabra, Latin inscriptions, huge paintings depicting the approved miracles, and finally the picture of the new saint in front of the altar of the chair of St. Peter. The papal throne is erected on an elevated platform, and alongside it are arranged the stalls for cardinals, patriarchs, archbishops, bishops, prelates, dignitaries who take part in papal functions. The frontal for the papal altar is richly embroidered in gold. On the facade of the basilica are placed inscriptions and a large canvas representing the new saint in glory. The cardinals all wear white damask mitres, and their train bearers are vested in crotchet, kata, and vimpa. The pontifical jeweler who has charge of the Pope's tiaras and mitres wears a silk cloak and a sword. Two extra papal tiaras are carried in the procession, in addition to the one on the Pope's head. And the Pope, wearing the mitre, sits and receives from the cardinal procurator two large painted candles. The canopy is spread over the Pope's head. Behind his seat, the large fans are carried, and then forms the Pope's guard of honor. The noble and Swiss guards, clad in full ceremonial costume, bring up the rear of the magnificent procession, which takes about 30 minutes to pass. On arriving at the doors of the basilica, the Pope is received by the chapter of St. Peter's, while the choir sings, "Tu es Petrus, you are Peter." When the Pope has entered the basilica, a triumphal march is played on the silver trumpets. Immediately, the ceremony of the obediences commences. The cardinals approach and kiss the Pope's hand. The patriarchs, archbishops, and bishops kiss the cross of the stole placed on the knees of His Holiness, while abbots general in the penitentiaries kiss His foot. Arrived at the foot of the throne, the advocate procurator kneels and addresses the following words to His Holiness. "Most Holy Father, the Most Reverend Cardinal here present, earnestly begs Your Holiness to inscribe the Blessed Maria Guglielma Emilia de Rodat in the catalogue of the saints of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to ordain that she be venerated as a saint by all the Christian faithful." The prelate secretary of the briefs replies in Latin that the Holy Father is very much edified by the virtues of the blessed, and by the miracles with which our Lord has made their glory resplendent. But before making any decision in a matter of such grave importance, he exhorts the faithful to assist him in imploring the divine assistance by the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary, of the holy apostles Peter and Paul, and of all the heavenly court. And then the proclamation in honor of the holy and indivisible Trinity, for the exaltation of the Catholic faith and the increase of the Christian religion, by the authority of our Lord Jesus Christ, of the holy apostles Peter and Paul, and by our own, after mature deliberation, ever imploring the divine assistance, by the advice of our venerable brethren, the cardinals of the Holy Roman Church, the patriarchs, archbishops, and bishops present in the eternal city, we decree and define as a saint, and we inscribe in the catalog of saints, the Blessed Maria Guglielma Emilia de Rodat, ordaining that her memory be celebrated with devotion every year in the universal church. End of quote. So there's more Pope kissing, Latin singing, bell ringing, and another saint is in heaven. I like Paul Blanchard's comment. He says, "It is scarcely necessary to point out that this ritual of display has nothing more to do with original Christianity than the worship of Stalin has to do with original socialism. There is not only no support in Christian tradition for such a use of Christianity, but all the weight of original Christian testimony is against such proceedings. In fact, it would be difficult to discover in all of history any person whose life record and personal habits conflicted more openly with ecclesiastical display and exaggerated ceremonialism than Jesus of Nazareth." End of quote. Yes, let's look at Jesus. The most spectacular thing he ever did while on this planet was sit on a donkey and ride into town. And he is God. God the Son of God. So who is this foul pretender to the throne of God but an antichrist, a false prophet, a deceiver of men? Oh, the heart pains at the thought of what claims these mere men make. Popes have been told at their coronation, "Thou art father of princes and kings, ruler of the world, vicar of Christ." I say blasphemy, because I can't think of a stronger word that is fit to print or to say to you. Have I lost compassion? Have I become negative? Am I being judgmental? You have to decide. But I tell you, the eyes of my heart see an impostor, a charlatan, bringing untold millions under his sway. What can my tongue do but respond in horror and in warning? Why, oh why, are so many other eyes blind, so many other tongues silent? Hear me. In this present age, only one has been given a worldly kingdom. At least that is what this one told Christ. And that is what Christ said of him to his disciples. Seeing the shape of the world from Eden until now, we can believe it. His name is Satan, Lucifer, and all who will reign under and over the kings of the earth in this day must reign under his banner. You expose yourself, woman of Babylon. You are naked before God and before the people who know their God. Your ways are the ways of the arch-deceiver, the prince of the power of the air, the king of the present kingdoms of this world. Only later, and soon we believe, will all the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. Ah, but when I wrote this, this was the 1990s, not the 1950s, definitely not the Middle Ages. Things are different now. I mean, not so much pomp, no coronations, and that's indeed true, but mainly because public outrage at such ostentation finally made cooler heads in the Vatican prevail. Look for it to reappear whenever people will allow it. Babylon is Babylon. The reader of cold print, no matter how warm the heart of the author, can be tempted to hate hearing such testimony. I remember when I first wrote these things, that I had only a heart filled with love and eyes filled with tears. Consider the plight of those masses of people who have loved and believed lies. May we all be prostrate before God that some will be saved. Catch the warmth of this glow before you go on in this story. You surely must know now that this book is not going to have a happy ending. I'm not telling God's story or our story. I'm telling hers, the woman. Oh, yes. 1950 is the year that the Church of Rome is told by the aforementioned Pope that it is now a matter of faith that they believe that Mary was taken up body and soul into heaven. And where did this new revelation come from? Well, we are often given the explanation of the piety of the people. That is, all the people believed this already. And increasing pressure was mounted by them for such a thing to become official doctrine. I call this democratic revelation. But God is more severe. He says, if you add to my words, you're cursed. We'll look at Mary again in Yugoslavia, but not right now. In fact, right now we've got to move over to a fellow named Bishop Sheen. And I say right now, but I mean next time. Next time we'll talk about Bishop Sheen, and we'll talk about the common market. And eventually we'll get to that great transformation that I was talking about. Thank you so much for being here again today. We're getting close to the end now. I hope that you'll stay with me then. Look around the website. There's 3,000 plus audios. There ought to be something else there that will be a blessing to you. I do hope so. Thank you so much. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun. We'll talk again real soon, Lord willing. Bye-bye.